So today we're going to talk about fostering healthy conflict. Are you breaking into a cold sweat at the thought? I might be a little bit, I confess. So this is for all of us out there who are like that. And here we are in the HR Hub with me, Andrea Adams. Keep listening to learn about this and all kinds of things related to HR. You can also find me on YouTube. Today, my guest is Kate Otting. Kate, I came across her when I was looking for someone to talk to about alternative dispute resolution. Someone from my audience asked about that. Her name came up because mediation is an aspect of alternative dispute resolution. Kate has had an interesting career for sure. She's the head of Interaction Management Associates, and they specialize in mediation. She has lectured. She's worked in South Africa. She's been the director of mediation for the Iowa Peace Institute and the Arizona Attorney General. Currently, she's the director of mediation for the city of Phoenix. Hi, Kate. How are you?
Great. Thanks.
That is such a mouthful, all of those jobs you've had. It must be so, so fascinating. However, we're going to just take a piece of that fascinatingness and share with my audience. Okay, so we're talking about conflict. When is it healthy? When is it harmful?
It does feel harmful to all of us, which, you know, is why we fear it, right? We talked about that fight or flight response fight or flight response, because our, evolution has taught us to fear it, right? Mm-hmm. And so it can become harmful when we let it fester, when we just let it get worse, or if we dive right in and start fighting and becoming defensive, which of course is in our nature and in our rights and, all of those things. That's our default response. And it can turn healthy when we can learn how to engage with more confidence, with more compassion, with patience and understanding. And a lot of that, I say all the time, is about becoming self-aware of our default responses. So the more we can build our own awareness of how we respond and learn how to engage with fearlessness, and it can become healthier. A lot that really kind of starts with one person. Mm-hmm. A lot of times it's easy to go, why do I have to be the one? How's that working for you? Fighting. And I find that if I can be patient and listen and sit back and let someone else vent or, get angry or come at me, it gives me time to kind of sit back and reflect on, I didn't think about how that impacted you, and own it and start working toward the resolution. One of my favorite books is Bill Urey's Getting to Yes, and another one is Getting Past No. And so those are a couple books of his. And he has these, 5 steps to breakthrough negotiation. And one of them is, stepping to the other person's side. And, one of the first steps is going to the balcony. So if you can imagine that you're at a balcony looking down on the conflict as though you're not a participant, it really gives you that time to not do all of those default things that we do, right? The fight or flight. And so that can help with a healthy, engagement in a conflict. Mm-hmm.
If you had one or two tips for someone who knows that there is some conflict that needs to be resolved and they want to take the healthy road, what tips do you have for them?
Anything that's difficult, I would say, do some deep breathing. But going to the balcony, like I said, read Bill Urey's book. I mean, it's a great primer on negotiation, the 5 steps to a breakthrough negotiation. I do that anytime I'm about to buy a car, because I just despise buying cars. I despise the negotiation involved in buying a car. And instead of throwing my hands up in the air and going without a car, I will rewrite the book so that I can go in and think about it from the salesperson's side. You know, what is it that they need from me? And what is it that I need from them? So stepping to the other person's side, this is something that hostage negotiators do. They step to the side of the person who's pointing a gun at them and saying, let me think what must be going on that drives you to do that. And so learning to engage from a different, from the other person's perspective. So stepping to their side and seeing it from their perspective and trying to figure out what it is they want first. And then can I live with that? You know, that sort of thing can be really, really useful.
That gives me a lot to think about. Okay. You know, but it's hard to do because we get so emotionally invested. How can we prevent our emotions from dominating?
Again, building, one of the things that is so important is just building your confidence in conflict, and which is why I'm a big proponent of mediation training. I mean, I've just learned that people who get trained in mediation skills learn how to see somebody else's conflict. And so, you know, you're observing this conflict unfold and then come out on the other side and resolve. And so it's easy to see that over and over and over and start to realize, maybe it's not so scary. You know, maybe it's not so frightening. And so, and all along the way, you're learning conflict resolution skills as a mediator. Mm-hmm. You're learning these negotiation skills. You're learning to model them, you know, such as reflecting back what someone is saying without judgment, right? Yeah. And so you said that, you know, the price of the car is $50,000. Huh. So, and I also hear you sounding that you want to sell a car today. So reflecting those things, you know, the frustration back and, you know, what, how many cars do you need to sell today? Let me help you.
Did it work? Did you get the car for cheaper, do you think?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah? Really?
And I got floor mats.
Oh, perfect.
Right?
Perfect. I feel like our approach to conflict can vary quite a bit culturally. I'm Canadian, so I feel like we're, at least it's a stereotype, that we're more adverse to conflict than Americans. I don't know if it's true or not. Can you comment, though, on the role culture plays?
Yeah, I mean, so much of it is the way we are, you know, the way we're raised, right? And it could be culture. It could be just our own community. It could be our family. My family is very conflict avoidant, and you know, we definitely are conflict avoidant, which can make it difficult because now I feel like in a lot of ways I've become desensitized to conflict, or at least that's what my sister would say.
Oh yeah,
I'm desensitized to conflict, and in a sense I am, because I don't fear it as much, right? So what might seem like a lively debate to maybe my sons and me, which we love to debate. And I think because I think they've learned the skills of confidence and conflict, that sort of, they don't see it as a conflict. Others might observe that and be afraid. They think, oh my gosh, it's getting too heated. I got to get out of here. And so you're right. It is. And people have different reactions to conflict. And so as a mediator, it's really important to be sensitive to that. That one person at the table may feel really confident and comfortable. They may have all the negotiation skills at their disposal, and the other person doesn't. We also have to recognize as mediators, what is their motivation for coming to the mediation table? Are they resolving this conflict for their community, maybe to save face? I have to go back home because my spouse expects something. And so that is important for us as mediators to really, to recognize But we also can't apply, we can't make assumptions, right? People, individuals come to the table. So it's easy to assume that because someone says they're from or they identify from a particular culture or community that they are going to negotiate that way. You know, they're going to be come at it that way. So we have to listen for what they're wanting, what they're needing. Mm-hmm. Mediation is really about interest-based negotiation, right? So that's the goal, is instead of the position, you know, that they come to the table, the tip of the iceberg, you know, they come to the table and say, you know, I want that. But oftentimes what's driving it is my spouse expects me to come home with an agreement and $5,000 in cash, you know, that sort of thing. Or they expect me to have my job back. And if I can't get my job back, I need to somehow frame it in a way that they can live with that, that I feel like I won and, you know, and you won as well. So framing it, helping the parties frame an agreement that is acceptable, not just for them, but anybody else involved that may be impacted or, you know, that because really people come to the table. One of their main goals is face saving. You know, they need to save face. We all do. You know, we need to go back home and say, I'm okay with that. You know, that I'm satisfied with this. And so sometimes we as mediators help them frame that agreement in a way that they can sort of sell it to others, whether it's coworkers or family members or community members or their faith community or whatever it is, you know, that they can live with.
That just has so many implications. I will not ask about that. Okay.
Well,
so
one of the things I was just going to say to you, the funny thing is my background, my education is in cross-cultural administration. I was going to save the world. That was my plan, you know. I got all this training and then I ended up in mediation and I realized that almost every mediation that I do has some sort of cross-cultural, and I put that in air quotes, component to it. And a lot of times people are speaking different languages. And I don't mean that with capital L. I mean, oftentimes people have different languages in terms of their, again, their ability to negotiate, their skills or the power, wherever they're coming from.
So in HR, we'll see these things going on and or it's going on with us. How do we prevent conflict from becoming damaging? I think I know the answer to this question, but even maybe we'll see it happening elsewhere. Do we have a role in preventing it from causing implosion or something?
By not avoiding it. I think that's the most important thing. So if it gets avoided, or, you know, if I see that so often where somebody in a leadership role ignores it and is afraid to confront the conflict, whether it's, you know, a department that's having a conflict and they're not really addressing it, or maybe a group of people that are really upset about a policy or something that's in place, and somebody in a leadership role is just ignoring that, not listening, not addressing it, and it just festers and people either quit or they make life difficult for everyone else. And, you know, I mean, all kinds of things. I could go on and on and on. I mean, you know, these patterns that can happen, you know, by starting to address the conflict and creating a culture that embraces, you know, confidence in conflict, that embraces healthy conflict, that's a winning solution, no doubt. You know, that just under creating a culture of healthy conflict, hands down, is ideal. And I mean, it's going to save time. It's going to save money. there's one organization that I've mediated a few, and I'm sort of there. They call me the emergency mediator, but the entire organization, it's huge. And it's a client of mine. But they have a culture now where each person, when they're hired, is handed a little card that's laminated with a 5-step process. If I have a dispute with someone, I'm going to sit down with them first.
Mm-hmm.
And here are the questions I'm going to ask them and they're going to ask me. So open-ended questions, you know, that start with what or how, and they address each other directly. And if at the end they don't feel satisfied, then okay, we agree to go to a supervisor. The supervisor then will try to work through it with them and informally mediate somehow. And then they bring in HR. And if that doesn't go anywhere, then they'll bring in the emergency outside mediator to do that. And because they're all trained in this process, by the time I'm brought in, the way they treat each other is so with such compassion and such understanding. It's phenomenal. It is out of, I mean, it's unlike any other organization.
Mm.
So, I mean, creating that sort of framework where it's systemic, by the time they get to me, they're really motivated to reach a resolution.
I find that a lot of people come to HR and they want HR to be this pseudo mediator and they don't want to do the same place. And it's all because they don't feel safe and they haven't had the conversation with their coworker because they don't feel safe, and they don't have the conversation with their supervisor because they don't feel safe. How do you create that safety? How do two employees create safety?
Well, the beautiful thing about mediation is the confidentiality, right? And so that is usually protected here in Arizona, where I live. It's protected by law. So it's codified in law, and that's typical almost anywhere. So the confidentiality is something that mediators hold sacred, which means that anything that's said in mediation, if somebody tried to subpoena my notes, they couldn't. I would have to remind the judge, hey, this was under the auspices of mediation, so they can't subpoena my notes. So we also destroy the notes generally. I usually will destroy the notes between sessions. But if it's something that I feel like I need to remember, I'll let them know. I'm going to hang on to these notes, but you can't have them. Nobody's going to understand them. But I do want to see you tear up your notes. So it's those. We're very careful about protecting the confidentiality of what's said in mediation. And what that does, it enables creativity. So people can say things, they can say things that may feel like maybe they wouldn't say it in any other context. Maybe they would say something that's kind of hurtful, but they can dial it back and own it, you know, those sorts of things. It gives them opportunities to do that, but they can also brainstorm creative solutions that nobody else thought of, you know, such as, you know, it would be great if we could just move him to a different building. You know, that actually came up in that one of the mediations. Like, maybe it would be great. And everybody kept saying that. And in fact, what was funny is when the professor himself said, it would be great if I could just move into another building. You know, like, who knew?
They're going to agree on that.
Yeah, so there was, you know, there was agreement there. When that gets thrown out, a lot of times people will laugh, ha, ha, ha. And then like, wait a minute. Let's go back to that. You know, that can become something that we can work with, you know, that could be part of the resolution.
What about mediation when there's a power imbalance? Power's been a thing I've been thinking about lately, and that it's, you know, comes in a lot of different forms, but
it does. Yeah.
What's your view on that?
Well, a lot of times there's power, you know, we talk about power away from the table, power at the table. So sometimes, you know, what I mean by that, sometimes you might have a supervisor and a subordinate. So they have a power imbalance away from the table.
Yeah.
And this is what often happens. It's never what, you know, what I think the conflict is going to be about. And then they come to the table. I had one, for example, where it was a supervisor and a subordinate, you know, the director, the head of a department and a subordinate, like several levels down. And I'm thinking, how did this even end up in mediation? And come to find out, the subordinates, somehow they became friends and no one else knew this. So they began, and the supervisor, the director said, I've made it a policy never to befriend anybody who works for me. And, you know, so I thought, well, you know, my reverse reaction was, well, that's kind of sad. But she had a reason for it. And she said, because, you know, I keep my friends separate from work. I keep my personal life separate. And, you know, this has always worked for me. And so she was upset with herself for letting this happen. But what made matters worse is the subordinate had stored her belongings in her garage, in the supervisor's garage. And she just somehow talked her into that, right? And this is, again, from the supervisor's perspective. She felt like she had been sort of bamboozled into this. And how did I let it get to this point? So what now happened is that the subordinate now has some power over her. She isn't coming to get her stuff. And it's a very unusual power. It is a very unusual power, right?
Yeah.
And the other thing too is the subordinate right out the bat turns to me and goes, by the way, I'm a trained mediator too. I'm really good at this. And the supervisor was an attorney. And she said, this is not my thing. I am not, you know, this just sitting here and working things. So power at the table also came from communication skills. One really had great engagement skills, but she was also extremely manipulative. And the other one wasn't having it, you know? So she felt manipulated. She felt like she'd been manipulated. I'm not going to be manipulated anymore. And in a lot of ways, was the victim. You know, I think too often people are very narrow-minded about what constitutes power. Mm-hmm. And that's a great example of power can be found in odd places or where you wouldn't expect it. Final question then, where can someone learn more?
Yeah, go to our website, imamediation.com, mm-hmm. check out the articles, mm-hmm. and we've got loads of articles that really can help anybody learn how to resolve conflicts, learn more about the skills involved, mm-hmm. how to get the training, that sort of thing. We also have freebies on there, you know, just listening skills checklist, pops up right there.
Yeah.
And I have a book, How to Respectfully Disagree Like a Pro. Mm-hmm.
I will put those links in the show notes. I'm going to wrap it up now. Well, thanks again, Kate. You remind me again about the importance of addressing conflict quickly and not letting it fester. I'm going to be looking for ways to do that, whether it's at work or elsewhere. But we've reached the end of this episode. Thanks for listening out there, and we'll catch you next time when I talk with another insightful guest.